So we are joined by a number of staff from EPA's Superfund program. And the first individual I'd like to call to the floor is Lucy Dunnington, who's joining you from our technology assessment branch. So Lucy, I'm going to turn the spotlight over to you and go ahead and I'll invite you to turn on your screen share to pull your slides up. Once we get your slides up, I'll confirm and you can formally begin the session. All right, everything looks great. Feel free to get started.
Okay, thank you, Jean. Let's see. And thank you everyone for attending our talk today. Welcome to Superfund Geophysics Case Studies from Region 4. First, you'll be hearing from myself, Lucila Dunnington. I work in EPA headquarters. I'll be speaking about how we tend to use geophysics on our Superfund sites and provide a brief intro to some of our surface geophysics technologies and some of our newer capabilities. Then we'll get to hear from Ben Venkowski, senior hydrogeologist in Region 4. He'll be talking about a case study in Roxboro, North Carolina, where they were solving the mystery of the floating boulders. And then we'll get to hear from John Fields in EPA's Office of Research and Development about his trip to Macon, Georgia, where he demonstrated a systematic and logical approach to finding an elusive contaminant source. Here's our EPA disclaimer of endorsement. The objective of this talk is not to endorse a particular service or product, but simply to provide some information and experience-based lessons learned from our geophysics at our sites. So to start us off, I'd like to get to know the audience a little bit and make sure everyone is engaged. So we're going to do some poll questions. Jean, could you launch the poll questions, please?
Absolutely. So at this time, we're going to launch a series of questions. The first group of questions is posed to everyone in the audience, questions 1 through 3. So a new window should have opened up on your screen, and you'll see a series of questions asking first, how many sites do you manage? And you can select from a series of options in a dropdown. Once you've selected your option, you can scroll down to your next question, asking how many of your sites have used or are currently using geophysical surveys. Again, you'll find another dropdown where you can select an answer. And then the third question, in your opinion, over the last 10 years, have you seen geophysics being used, either more, less, the same over time, or I'm not sure? Once you've shared an answer to the questions, you'll see a small blue submit button in the bottom right, and that'll cast your vote. Right now, about 55% of the audience have shared their responses. I'll give you just a few more moments to review and submit your answers, and then we'll take a look at how you have responded to get a sense of who's joining us in the live broadcast. Remember, there's no wrong answer to these questions. It's merely meant to help educate our presenters to understand your perspective on today's topic. If you're having any technical difficulties with those polling questions, feel free to use the Q&A to just write in your own responses, or just let us know. We'll be happy to work with you to troubleshoot those answers. All right, with about 3/4 of the audience having sent their response in, I'm gonna go ahead and close this poll in 3, 2, 1, and let's share those results. Now, you'll see a new pop-up on the screen, which will show you a distribution of results. So it does look like over 1/3 of our audience has more than 10 sites that they are actively managing. About 1/4 of you are working between 6 and 10. And then the rest of you are somewhere between 1 and 5, but almost 10% have no sites that they're actively managing. So that's we appreciate that information. And then of those who are managing sites, it does look like almost 1/2 of you have used or are using geophysical surveys at only 1 to 2 of those sites. About 1/4 of you are using it at 3 to 5. And then about 20% of the audience indicated that they're not using it at any of their sites. So again, we appreciate that background information. And then for that third question, it does look like most or more of you indicated that you're seeing, in your opinion, over the last 10 years, you're seeing geophysics being used more. That got about 42% of the responses. About 1/4 of you were not sure, and then about 20% felt it was about the same over time. But again, more felt like it was being used more. So that's great. I'm going to stop sharing these, and we're going to open another bank of questions. However, these particular questions are designed only to be used by those of you who have used geophysics. So if you have not used geophysics at one of your sites, please do not share your responses. But for those of you who have, you'll see 4 additional questions with an option to share additional information on one of your responses. So the first question we'll now ask, at your sites, did the geophysical surveys help? It's a drop down for yes, no, or not sure. And then the second question, as you scroll down, will ask which of the following objectives were geophysical surveys used for? And you can check off all that apply. Was it CSM development, conceptual site model development, that is, plume mapping, remediation monitoring, or other? If you selected other, you'll have a free text box where you can share a short description of the other uses for the surveys at your site. And then as you scroll down from there, you'll see a fourth question. If you didn't find that they were helpful, you will essentially be able to describe what the main problem or impediment for success was. And again, you'll be picking from options, the survey not meet objectives because of data quality, resolution, or an inability to see your planned targets. Was the survey effective, but it just didn't help with what you were trying to achieve? Were you unable to understand or interpret those results, or is that not applicable? Were there other issues? And then there's a final question asking if you would use a geophysical survey again, either yes, no, or maybe. Once you've shown your responses to those questions, again, you can hit the blue submit button and that will collect your responses. I noticed that one or two people are indicating they're having some issues with the poll population. If you are having a challenge, remember we do have the questions shown on the screen. So you're also welcome to just share in a free response in the Q&A if you're unable to respond to that interactive window in the poll. It looks like about half of the audience has responded. I'm not seeing any additional responses coming in. So I'm going to go ahead and end the poll in 3, 2, 1, and let's take a look at those results. And so as I'm scrolling through here, it does look like for those of you who did use geophysical surveys, overwhelmingly more than 90% indicated that yes, these surveys did help. When we look at what objectives they were used for, it looks like 3/4 of you said CSM development and about 40% plume mapping, with about 1/4 of you using it for remediation monitoring, and then again, almost 30% using it for other purposes. And for those of you who didn't, one of your main problems or impediments for success with those surveys is that the survey either did not meet objectives because of data quality issues, or you couldn't understand or interpret the results. But a number of you have indicated that that was just not applicable at your particular sites. And then again, which I think our instructors will be happy to see, it looks like 93% of you who have used geophysics in the past would definitely use them again. So I want to thank everybody for sharing that input. I'm going to close these results and I'll turn the floor back to you, Lucy.
Okay, great. Thank you everyone for participating in the poll, and thanks Jean for moderating that. Now again, I'm Lucy Dunnington. I work in EPA headquarters where we try to take all the experience from all of our sites across the nation and make recommendations on how to improve. So a few different headquarters programs, including the Superfund Optimization Program, our Grain Remediation Program, and the new Data and Evidence Program, which rigorously evaluates site data to support programmatic decision-making, are converging on the finding that in order to make our cleanups faster, cheaper, greener, more sustainable, we need to up our characterization. And at this point, we have a very good toolkit of characterization technologies. First up, everyone's favorite or the most familiar is boring logs. You can get tangible geologic information from the core or chips. It can turn into a monitoring well or extraction injection well, so it may serve multiple purposes. But this information can also be qualitative and inconsistent depending on the logger. It can also be costly and destructive and give you a single point of data from which to extrapolate. But that extrapolation may not be appropriate in every subsurface setting. Next up is our borehole high-resolution site characterization tools, HRSC tools. I'm including in this category borehole geophysics, like nuclear magnetic resonance. It's getting a lot of buzz recently, NMR, MIP, HPT, GeoProbe, Waterloo, televiewers. These provide continuous or quasi-continuous downhole data, which I think is especially valuable in geologies with lateral continuity and vertical heterogeneity. And today we won't be focusing on this tool set because there are a lot of good trainings on borehole tools that have come out recently. For instance, please check out this Kluwin archive of another great offering by Ben Pankowski on groundwater HRSC. So you can see a big chunk of our tools are borehole based, which implies that we have the ability to interpolate or extrapolate from borehole to borehole. But in a lot of places in the country, especially in the so-called overburden, which is relevant to remediation, this is not true. We cannot necessarily linearly extrapolate from borehole to borehole. We have lateral heterogeneity in the strata. And this is where the focus of today's talk comes into play. Surface geophysics. Surface geophysics like ground penetrating radar, electrical resistivity, electromagnetic, seismic, can help you fill in the gaps between your boreholes. If you have a site, if you have site features with poor lateral continuity, you can use surface geophysics to scan your site for those features. Here's my little cartoon resistivity. So for the engineers out there, when I say poor lateral continuity, I mean things like buried drums, pipes, tanks, free product. And for the geologists out there, when I say poor lateral continuity, I mean fractured bedrock, karst features, saprolite, buried channels. The general rule of thumb with geophysics is the higher the resolution, the shallower the depth of investigation, and vice versa. So with borehole tools, you can get really high resolution right along the borehole. And with surface geophysics, you can get a deeper and broader investigation with less resolution than what we see with the borehole tools. This technology is 100 years old at this point and employs pretty basic physics that you probably learned about in high school. But we have some newer collection and processing capabilities like UAV and 3DVA that have improved our collection and integration of this data. So now maybe you're wondering, why are we talking about region four? What's special about region four? Well, if we turn our attention to this geologic map from the USGS, get my pointer, we can see region four is covered in this purple material, which the USGS calls residual material, which is formed by the partial chemical dissolution and physical disintegration of bedrock. Patchy, poorly sorted, variably weathered bedrock overburden. You may know it as saprolite or a regolith or laterite, so associated soil type. In region four, we see a lot of reworked bedrock material like limestone, shales, igneous, metamorphic rock that have been chemically and physically weathered. And this setting is challenging for remediation because in addition to the more predictable structures of bedrock bedding or foliation, here's a little metamorphic foliation bedrock. There's another cross-cutting layer of weathering structures you see in this little cartoon image. And those weathering structures can also dictate contaminant migration. There's a sort of vertical permeability gradient that varies laterally across the site. And this is the nature of the contaminated surface at many region four sites. Our first case study is in Roxboro, North Carolina, located at this purple star, smack dab in the middle of this purple residual material. And our second case study is at this yellow star in Macon, Georgia, at the border of the purple residual material and yellow stream river deposits. And besides the contaminant taking an unpredictable focal path, there's also issues with identifying top of bedrock. So boring holes may think they're hitting bedrock when they're actually finding a large boulder. And also you can't necessarily extrapolate bedrock surface level from borehole to borehole. And this complicates remedy designs that aim for top of bedrock like excavation, PRBs, permeable reactive barriers, cutoff walls, solidification, and others. Other geologic features with low lateral continuity posing challenges for remediation region four include karst, fractured bedrock, and buried channels, which is potentially why region four also happens to be one of the highest users of geophysics. 72% of all NPL sites in region four, this southeast region, have deployed some kind of geophysics. The most common surface geophysics we use are ground penetrating radar, electrical resistivity, and electromagnetics, and seismic. So I'm going to briefly go over this technologies now that we've established why region four and why surface geophysics. Then we'll get on with the case studies. So the first technology I'll talk about is ground penetrating radar. Ground penetrating radar, or GPR, sends electromagnetic waves into the ground that are about the same frequency as a landline telephone, if anyone remembers those. When it encounters another material, it'll reflect or travel at a different velocity or refract. It's very good at detecting shallow structures, kind of in the tens of feet range. It usually is used for utilities, underground storage tanks, mine tunnels. And it's better at telling you where and not exactly what. So you should have an idea of what you're looking for when you go out with this instrument. Attenuating clays or reinforced concrete can limit the depth of investigation. For instance, there was one site that was investigating a leaking underground storage tank, and the GPR found the top of the tank very easily, but then the sludge from the tank attenuated the signal. So they used electrical resistivity tomography or ERT to map the extent of the sludge from the tank. So you can get around some of these limitations by coupling different geophysics together. Okay, so here are a few of the GPR deployment methods. The older versions being the drag along method, uphill both ways in the snow, old school, and the classic lawnmower method. And then we have this newer drone or UAS deployed GPR, where you can see we can access previously difficult to access areas like underwater, steep slopes, unstable ground. And GPR is really nice because you can get results in real time. So there's usually a little monitor attached to the instrument that shows you the reflections you're getting. So please enjoy this animation I made using public domain images showing how you can get GPR results in real time. Woo! So an image like this will appear on the little monitor attached to the machine. This one's revealing a buried channel down to about 12 feet. And you can get whatever geologist you have milling around the site to tell you this looks like a buried channel with a bank and a point bar geomorphology, which would indicate a meandering channel. So GPR is relatively inexpensive and easy to use. And people will often use them like a metal detector on their site where they just kind of do object locates as well. So the next technology we're going to go over is electrical resistivity, aka electrical resistivity tomography, ERT, aka electrical resistivity imaging, ERI. Some people just call it resistivity. And the way this works is it injects a current into the ground and then reads a voltage and derives a resistivity value using a variation on Ohm's law, V equals IR. The current is sent in with something similar to a car battery, or maybe literally a car battery I've used on some of my surveys. It's good for distinguishing between materials down to about 100 feet, usually. It works well for materials that have high electrical contrasts, like the difference between host rock and mine tunnels, or karst features, igneous versus some sedimentary rock, saturated versus unsaturated zone, and recently, of increasing interest is the ability for this to detect microbial activity in the subsurface. The deliverable for this technology is often this kind of trapezoidal pseudo section with hypnotic resistivity patterns with some interpretation and potential follow-up boring locations. Our case study speakers will have a lot more to say about this technology, so I won't go too deep into it. But the story for this image is that they had some road subsidence in a post-mining town in Ohio, and they decided to do a resistivity line to check for old mining tunnels underground. So they did a 72-meter long survey, about 240 feet long, and detected four highly resistive features to further investigate with shallow boring. So that's B2, B1, B22, and B27 were the suggested boring locations. So they did borings and found mine tunnels between about 10 to 25 feet deep, where I put the little white circles. So at this site, they were using it for road stability issues, but at a Superfund site, you could use it to see where your mining influence water is going or your mine tunnel geometry. And thanks to our better data handling capability and software, time-lapse electrical resistivity is growing in popularity, as shown by the increasing articles in the last 20 years in this little graph I have from Web of Science. It's been used for amendment injection monitoring, plume migration, along with tracer studies, water infiltration, and aquifer storage research. I have here an animation that was developed by Tim Johnson and others from the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory and the USGS. Please see the cited paper shown here, or the 2018 CLUIN webinar by Fred Day Lewis to learn more about this project. But basically, this takes place in Brandywine, Maryland. They're injecting an amendment to stimulate bioremediation, and they're showing a change in conductivity, which is the reciprocal of resistivity. So first, you can see the amendment infiltrate the desired aquifer strata, so you get that good horizontal distribution of the amendment. And then they stop injecting the amendment after about a year. But then, in an exciting twist, the conductivity increases again in the system. So now you can see the increase in the conductivity again. So they investigated why that was and found that there was biomineralization of iron to iron sulfide that was enhancing the conductivity of the aquifer. So not only did they get to see the amendment was delivered as intended to the right strata, but also the after effects of biostimulation. So I thought that was a cool study. I'll just briefly touch on this application of doing joint seismic resistivity surveys, like the one I worked on in Colorado. So in this configuration, a line of these little 3-inch seismic geophone probes sits along a line of 9-inch resistivity metal stakes. This is a powerful combination because you get good lithologic structure information from the seismic survey and along with material information from the resistivity survey. Seismic is also a common standalone technology that operates much like GPR, except it can go deeper, like kilometers deep, and it uses acoustic waves instead of electromagnetic waves. The seismic signal can be propagated by a special truck, sometimes called a thumper, or an explosion for very deep, multiple mile long surveys. But this kind of survey that we did is the most common and easy to implement. Here's our little mighty seismic source. All right, so he struck the metal plate with a sledgehammer and the other guy saw that they got a good reflection. So he nodded. So you can see it's very safe, non-invasive, even maybe tedious. But then you get this nice structural information. So in this example, they were looking for preferential flow paths of MTBE they suspected was moving through bedrock in Virginia. The combined seismic resistivity survey gave a nice delineation of the bedrock surface, saprolite depth, and some boulders and fractures down to about 150 feet, which helped them place relevant monitoring wells, but also helped them present the conceptual site model to community stakeholders. So this was a nice case study from the ITRC Advanced Site Characterization Tools Collection. And Ben's case study also shows an example of this geophysical combination. So I'll let him get more into it. And the last geophysics we'll cover is electrical or electromagnetics. And you might see it in one of two ways, either like a big hoop, either planted on the ground or in an aerial survey, like this photo on the left. Or you might see someone schlepping around what looks like a long, heavy bar or a giant level, like the photo on the right. These objects are inducing an electromagnetic field for materials in the ground. So electromagnetic instruments read the ground electrical properties, much like electrical resistivity. But I see this technology most often for creating shallow surface maps that show anomalies, like the example I have on the next slide. The anomalies might indicate groundwater seeps for detecting contaminated groundwater entering surface water systems, finding buried faults, drums, metal objects, and chemical spills. And you can see it's pretty easy to walk around with one of these instruments. You can set yourself up with a GPS and then get correlated maps as soon as you get back to the office. It again is susceptible to electrical noise, so things like metal structures and power lines should be accounted for in the survey or in the interpretation. So here's a typical result from an EM investigation shown on the left. This was a survey completed by the EPA emergency response team. The instrument picks up the metal gate. You can see a little red blob here, and then also the property fence. So you can see they called out the signal coming from the property fence. But then you can also see the subsurface anomalies that they will follow up on with borings or trenches labeled A, B, C, and D. So how do you deploy geophysics at your site? You don't have to know everything about geophysics. There's a lot of people who can help. If you're not in the EPA, you have access to good contractors and subcontractors with these capabilities. And if you are in the EPA, you can go to your regional science support center and talk to someone like Ben Vankowski in Region 4. Or you can go to the Office of Research and Development via your Superfund technical liaison and access folks like John Fields. You can reach out to our emergency response team. They have all the geophysics we talked about today and more, and the expertise to deploy and interpret the results. And if your investigation goals align with USGS research initiatives, you can access the USGS through a couple of our interagency agreements. You can reach out to me for information on how to get started on any of those paths. And lastly, we've recently released a few publicly available resources. Our Cluin Geophysical Methods goes over all the technologies we talked about today and more with case studies and comparative costs and capabilities. That's the first link. And then also the EPA Environmental Geophysics page developed by Dale Workima in our Office of Research and Development has good technical information and a library of scientific papers, as well as selection tools in which you can populate fields with information about your site and investigation goals, and it spits out geophysics tools that would be appropriate. So that's all I have to share today. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Ben Vankowski, who will tell us about the tale of Roxborough, North Carolina. Take it away, Ben.
Okay. So thank you, Lucy, for that introduction here. Let me get... I'm trying to start my video. Okay, so presentation mode. So good afternoon or good morning.
Ben, yes, before ma'am. You go any further, we're still seeing Lucy's slides. You'll need to hit the green share button in Zoom.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Screen share. Yes. How's that?
Everything looks great. Thank you.
Gene, excuse me.
Everything looks great. Go right ahead.
I shall. Well, hello again. I'm glad to bring this bit of a case study to you. It's from a place in northern North Carolina. The next county over is actually Virginia. But it was a bit of a conundrum. And geophysics was suggested to try to understand what was going on, and it seems to have worked out quite well. So I'll walk you through my pages here. So the GMH Electronics site is in Roxborough, North Carolina. And pointer options, laser. Here we go. And just a small mom and pop kind of a place. There was a crossroads. There was a general store that had gas station associated with it. So there was actually petroleum problems in the front and VOCs and dioxane in the back because their wastewater went into a septic system. So, you know, quite a long time ago, the first problem with gasoline was noted in some private wells. All that sort of ended up triggering the Superfund process. And we put in some private water lines in 2009. And then proceeded to go through the RIFS process. And then the 2014 Record of Decision selected a soil vapor extraction and an in-situ chemical reduction for the solvent source area. So this is actually a quote from the from the rod. So this is the view from above. The septic tank located in the breezeway, but the drain field lines came out into this area here. This figure on the right, this kind of lighter pinkish area is actually the higher concentration area. And this is where the groundwater is flowing out to the north, northeast, and there's a spring over here someplace. Anyway, that's basically where our this VOC plume is migrated towards. Overall, the site geology is typical of this Piedmont area of North Carolina. This reference here says Harned and Daniel, but I know it's actually based on the work of Ralph Heath, the granddaddy of North Carolina geology. Maybe the saprolite's 42 feet thick. The wells were installed. There was a transition zone. And then below that was fractured bedrock. The Roxborough met a granite, and some of the private wells were really quite deep. This is a water table map here on the lower right. You can see that it's basically a dome structure because it indeed is the top of a hill. We had some work done by the U.S. Geological Survey to run their borehole geophysics, and that's how we know about the number of fracture zones per bedrock well, as well as just a better characterization overall. One thing I want to point out here is this transition zone here. It says thin with rock fragments, but as you'll find out, that word thin may not have been the right adjective for use in Roxborough. And perhaps we shouldn't just rely upon some 40-year-old conceptual site model diagrams to, you know, bring forward. You have some local knowledge that revises that understanding. So this is the layout for the injection wells and recovery wells that was in the remedy. And it looked like there were going to be these yellow are the superficial aquifer injection wells. And this row would be the extraction wells in the superficial. The green, this row of green was the injection wells in the bedrock. And this row wells was the extraction wells in the bedrock. You know, basically keeping up with the general groundwater flow direction to the northeast. But they tried, and it just wasn't working. They tried to drill quite a number of injection wells. First, they were trying to do some characterization with direct push, and they kept running into a rock that was unexpected. They tried additional drilling methods, and eventually, John Jenkins, to his credit, suggested a geophysical survey. And because they were just, you know, spinning their wheels, they didn't just, what was going on in the subsurface? We didn't really know. So it actually added up to an additional about 2.5 years. And one of the things that Lucy wanted me to suggest is that this is the audience for this presentation could well be mostly project managers. And this is, you know, to give you an opportunity to see about where there might be solutions to the problems you're having in getting your remedies installed. Probably first in characterization of the site and then during the remedy installation. But it turned out, you know, the additional costs included additional drilling, the geophysical survey, and something that's every RPM loves, is switching contractors in the middle of some additional activities. So they ran two different kinds of surveys. One is this electrical resistivity tomography. Like Lucy talked about, the electrodes are laid out in a line, and then it calculates the resistivity between that point and all the others. The electronics have just gotten so smart these days. It used to be really a rudimentary kind of a process, but now there's software in the black box. And it just, as John can tell you, the work done in Macon is just, it happens so much quicker these days. The spacing of the electrodes controls the depth because it acts as a bit of an arc between the main electrode and the one you're measuring against. And so in this case, the black line that kind of snakes around this figure is the difference between a higher resistivity rock and the less resistivity, which is probably more like the soil or the saprolite in this part of the world. And you can see, there's this, possible interference artifact in this at this location here, but there are definitely these lighter green. It's hard to think of a boulder as floating, but it is suspended up in the soil column above the bedrock. And this is the things that we were running into. When you thought you were going to 40 feet deep, and then you got all of 8, what the hell's going on? Kind of a thing, So we did both resistivity and we did a seismic survey, and it's a similar thing. Lucy again laid out the basics of it, and you input some energy in there, and then you measure the speed of the sound waves. And again, there's this zone of soil running over here around 20 feet, but this zone of more dense material, aka the floating boulders, up here in this 10 to 15 foot range. That changed our conceptual site model, because now we knew that there were places that had rock shallow and then additional soil below that before you got to the actual bedrock. This is another transect at the site. Again, here's the resistivity survey with the floating rock. This is that interference artifact. And then down below here is the seismic survey. And again, it's the same sort of thing, about 8 to 20 feet or so, and this is maybe 5 to 20, maybe a little deeper over here. But anyway, these anomalies show up with the two different methods, which is a confirmation. That way you're not relying entirely on one type of measurement. It's better to have some confirmation. Give the geophysicist the chance to think about it a bit and see what actually shows up when you compare one to the other, and provide a more comprehensive evaluation that way. So this was one of the images out of the geophysical report, based upon both the seismic and the resistivity surveys. And it is, the depth to rock, basically depth to bedrock. And you can definitely see that they're in these blue areas, things are much deeper. This area up here is actually fairly deep. Then there are these series of probably boulders, floating boulders along here. I find this feature here kind of interesting, the one that goes diagonally. That is in keeping with the regional strike for the tectonics in this area. So maybe there's a fracture here in the bedrock, and that's allowed this additional deeper weathering to occur. But it's an interpretation. So if you were going to drill to try to put your injection wells in, maybe you shouldn't be drilling in the green part. Stick to the blue part. You're going to get more, you're going to get better drilling and more productive injections. And overall, just that's what you spent the money for, to try to understand this. I finished this presentation up a few weeks ago, but since then, I've had a chance to interact with the project managers and his consultant, and I wanted to use that interaction to explain to you something a little, an additional thing. Please use the geophysical information that you spent so much time and energy collecting. And I'm going to show you a little trick that I've learned. It's not everything has to be. I do appreciate, the three-dimensional visualization and all that. But this little trick is something I've learned to do. You take a screenshot of an image and go and make it a little more transparent. And then you overlay it onto the map that actually has the depth of bedrock in it. And you can see that here. So this image up here, let me do that. No, it won't. But anyway, this upper image is that image. And you can see where the proposed extraction wells are to be. But when I did this little exercise, looks like extraction injection well number two is actually in where some of the shallow rock is going to be. We had a discussion, and that well has been moved about 10 feet over to the northwest. So it'll actually be able to be drilled more effectively, actually then have the extracted water and the injected water go into the non-rock part and actually be more successful. So whatever you do, don't ignore all the effort that you put into understanding what was going on there. Make sure you understand all that. I did like Lucy's discussion about the use of some of the other geophysics, especially sort of time-lapse stuff. And I have to be careful not to recommend things that cost too much money. But what we're going to end up doing is monitor the water levels in these wells around here and measure the extraction process and the injection process to see where it goes. Just some better monitoring so you can actually understand where your injections are going. Now that you know to put the wells in the right place. So there were some clues. The name of the place is Roxboro, for goodness sakes. But down the hill a ways was this boulder field. And this is a quote from the USGS's report from that work there. Boulders so numerous, difficult to distinguish between outcrops and float. So yes. This is probably a good indication of what the subsurface looks like. Now that you're off the hill a bit and the soil's had a chance to erode away. So this would be a difficult place to try to drill through unless you've got the right equipment. So some of the lessons. I'm winding down to my last 4.5 minutes here. When you're working at a site that might have some shallow bedrock problems, you should give it some additional consideration for these non-invasive surveys. They don't take a lot of time. I don't think they're prohibitively expensive. And certainly better than, having your project delayed for 2 or 2.5 years. And this is probably my fault here, is about using the old hydrogeologic conceptual site model. Not actually seeing those rocks out in the field and thinking that could be projected back up into the subsurface at the site. We talk about lifelong learning, and that's one of my lessons at this site. So there are other types of geophysics. Lucy went through a number of these, ground penetrating radar, the EM surveys, and we do have a number of, especially for the EPA folks on the call this afternoon, there are certainly internal resources available. So, or you could just put in a call for somebody with X-ray vision. That would solve all your problems, don't you think? But I don't know if Superman's available upon demand. So that, ladies and gentlemen, is my presentation. I've got, looks like I've got 3 minutes left or so. And I think we're headed to a 5-minute Q&A.
That is exactly correct. Thank you so much, Ben. I'll remind the audience, you have access to a Q&A button at the bottom of your screen where you can privately submit your comments and questions for our presenter. If you don't have any questions, you can also send a message into the Q&A indicating that. That'll help us manage our time. Ben, I do have some questions that came in. I'm going to start with those. Okay. And
Should I stop sharing?
No, you can leave that on. We might be referencing one of your slides. So,
right. Okay.
This first one, they're asking a strike plate or other seismic source dipole resistivity array. I'm not sure if you can comment or respond on that question.
Well, the strike plate is what Lucy showed in her seismic little video. It's just you whack a big plate with a sledgehammer. I think I'm going to have to defer to John, the dipole to dipole. He's much more skilled in geophysics than I am.
Okay. Well, John, did you want to chime in?
So I think the question was specifically about what method was used at that site. So mm-hmm. what seismic method was utilized and then what resistivity method was utilized.
I don't think I actually remember that. It was 10 years ago, you know, or not 8 years ago at this point. So I guess I should have read a little more in depth about the report as opposed to just using the images.
Sure, no problem. Ben, can you confirm, was a fracture trace analysis completed? If so, did it line up with any of those lower bedrock sections?
It was not done at this site. I've used that technique in other parts of the Piedmont, and because this, all the land around here had been part of people's yards and farms and gardens for so long, there really was very little undisturbed, semi-natural, you know, ground that could indicate a fracture. We really only saw that fracturing once we did the geophysics. But okay. It's definitely a way to go because I knew a guy in New England, and that's how he made his living off of finding water supplies, is with aerial photographs and finding those fracture intersections and the enhanced permeability and storage and all that. So,
okay. Ben, can you comment on any limitations of doing geophysical surveys in urban areas?
Well, certainly for resistivity surveys, it's a problem because there's so many things that have an EM signature. Power lines, just fences create their own galvanic effect, I believe. In traffic, you know, just for a seismic survey, just the big trucks rolling down the road jiggle the ground enough that it interferes with your survey. So it's a tougher environment. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, if I had to choose, I might use more direct push sampling to try to understand that kind of stuff. It's just okay. You're likely to have less interference.
Okay. So just one of the participants, it looks like they're trying to confirm, So geophysical surveys are complementary investigative tools that they are used with other methods to help make sense of the data. You would never just use a geophysical survey alone at a site when you're characterizing things.
Well, we wouldn't know because it's in our industry, it's seen as a complementary service. Certainly okay. In the oil field, you know, you're running stuff offshore. It's their primary tool because it's so damn expensive to get a rig out there, you know, in the Gulf or even on the ground itself. If you're in, you know, where Oklahoma or someplace. Yes, but for us, it's plus many of the, you know, I work in Superfund. So many of the sites I'm working on have been around for 30 or 40 years, at least identified as a problem that long. And it becomes an additive quantum of information. It's rarely the initial step out, the okay. initial characterization.
So they had a follow-on to that question, and they ask, how would you combat an RP, and I believe they mean a responsible party, who considers geophysical tests to be extraneous that aren't really needed because you've already done other investigative work?
All right, well, I think that sort of kicks into the other topic that that I'm involved in is high-resolution site characterization. Do you have sufficient data density to actually make your remedial decisions? You know, RPs are notoriously stingy, shall we say, is a more diplomatic word, with their resources. And what we're finding is that these techniques are really not, well, certainly they're less expensive than a failed remedy. And if you can better design what your remedy is going to be, you have a better chance of success with that. I work on old military sites, and sometimes it's 700 feet between monitoring wells. Mm-hmm. That's insufficient for high-resolution site characterization. Do a lot of screening before you actually install your wells. So you just have to assess where can there be data gaps in understanding where the contaminant distribution is, and, you know, get an idea about the time it takes, or, you know, if it's only going to be, you know, $32,000 relative to a $3 million remedy, that's a reasonable investment, I think.
Okay.
Anyway.
All right. Thank you, Ben. I think in the interest of time, what we're going to do is move on to our next speaker. But before we go away, I just wanted to let the audience know we were able to look at one of the site reports and confirm, Ben, that it was dipole and a 20-pound sledgehammer strike plate that was used. So
keep that in mind for next time.
Excellent. So it's my pleasure to call up our next presenter to the floor, and he is John Fields from ORD here at EPA. So, John, I'm going to swap the spotlight, turn the floor to you. I can see your slides are up. You can feel free to begin whenever you're ready.
Awesome. Thank you. So today I'm going to talk to you about the Macon Naval Ordnance Plant in Macon, Georgia. I'll go over the site background, site geology, and then talk about our phase one electrical resistivity imaging surveys, our phase two verification, and then the lessons learned from that. There we go. So the facility is a former Navy operations. Okay. Sorry. So the facility was formerly operated by the Navy from 1941 to 1965. And then after that, was operated by a private contractor for the Navy until 1973. So we're talking over three decades of producing ordnance, and that's triggers, detonators, flares, and other small pieces like that. At the site, they had metal plating, they had transformers, they had storage tanks for fuels, they had wastewater treatment plant and storm drains. And of course, they had explosives manufacturing buildings. Today, the facility is owned by the Macomb-Bibb County Industrial Authority, where they house several different tenants that produce different things. And through all the previous investigations at the site of soil, groundwater, surface water, and sediment, they did not find PCBs. They did not find metals. They did not find hydrocarbons. They did not find explosives. They did find TCE, and it correlates well with where the stormwater outfall is at. This is a map of the site. The yellow box gives us the boundary of that Navy property. The green boxes within that one are all of the buildings that did general processes for the Navy. The pink ones are buildings that did explosives handling or storage. And then the blue box is going to be new buildings that were not part of that Navy complex. There is also the wastewater treatment plant to the far left of the facility and the stormwater outfall. Then within this dashed lighter box, we're going to zoom in, and that's going to be a map of the utilities. So as we're all learning going forward, utilities are actually becoming, we are finding that they are the pretty much the highways for contaminants. They are a preferential pathway. So knowing where we have storm drains and sewers at the site will help us understand possibly where contaminants will go. And as you see, a lot of those lines lead out to the historic stormwater sewer outfall right here. The red box is going to be our area of investigation. Geology at the site can really be broken down into three different types of lithology. You've got unconsolidated sand, silts, and clays, which are above a confining clay, which is above the Tuscaloosa aquifer. And if you look at the map, so the top of a soil core is here. It goes down from surface to depth, and then from right to left. So that confining clay is here. And then below that, you'll eventually reach the Tuscaloosa aquifer. This is a cross-section of that geology, so it's really simplified. But again, you've got unconsolidated sediments above the clay, above the aquifer. Groundwater in the area typically flows from north to south, but within our area now in black, flows from northwest to southeast. And if we look at a plume map created by one of the contractors for the RP at the site ERM, you can see that the plume typically follows that northwest to southeast trend. The different concentrations at the site, this map is done in PPB, but the darkest green area is roughly 200,000 PPB. So we're talking 200 PPM. The historic stormwater outfall is at the north, as at the origination of this plume. And if we look at this monitoring well here, look at a log of it. If we look at the PID readings collected as they collected that soil core, we see that we peak at around 8,000 PPM right at the top of that confining clay. So it's clear that TCE at the site is acting like you would expect a DNAPL to act, where it's hitting that clay unit and running along the surface of it. But I want to draw your attention to this area. As we collected our data, we ended up not investigating a historic stormwater outfall. There's a lot of direct push technology data collected in that area to get a relatively high resolution characterization of it. But there's not very much data to the northeast portion of the site. And once we collected our data, we shifted our focus over there, and we'll show you why. But in that area, there was a former explosives mixing house, and there's a bunch of storm drains in that area. So we do have the potential for contaminants as well as the potential for transportation. So this is kind of a question. There is a monitoring well up in that area, and that is, you'll see that that doesn't necessarily go to where we believe to the depth necessary. And we'll just kind of fill in a potential data gap. So we planned to collect a survey like this. We planned to collect a survey around that known source area, which is a stormwater outfall. What we actually did was not characterize that area and instead focused on this potential data gap. And you'll see as we get into it, but anytime you're doing these surveys, the last thing I want to do is go back into the woods, spend a day or two chopping stuff down or cutting through a bunch of brush to let the survey and find out that my generator didn't start or something's not working right. So we started in the open field, and you can see on this image on the left with that plume map placed there. We had ran two north-south surveys in that open field, relatively easy and quick to collect those data. We should have crossed really contaminated areas. So we should have seen some sort of signature. And we know from the direct push, they were seeing concentrations indicative of DNAPL. So if we have DNAPL at the site, we should see some sort of signature in our surveys. The third survey we collected was this east-west survey on the right. And this is what caused us to really shift our focus with characterizing going forward, or where we wanted to collect data going forward. Looking to the left, this is MIP Pro pushes using direct push by Cascade, one of the other RP's contractors. So this is showing PID concentrations. The white line indicates where we collected our survey, and we ran it right over the highest concentration area for their PID readings. And when we look at our surveys here on the right, we don't see anything remarkable. The bottom survey here is just in a regular scale of resistivity in ohmmeters per meter. This scale is the same data, just a different scale. It's a log scale of that ohmmeters per meter. What that does is it allows us to try and work out some of those anomalies or artifacts that may be messing with certain features in a regular survey. So you'll see both of these as we go forward. But as I mentioned, we should have seen strong concentration in this location. And really all you see is a relatively resistive layer over a relatively lower resistivity layer or a relatively conductive layer. And we mapped the confining clay based off of the prior data. So you can kind of see that unconsolidated sands and silts above that lower clay. Now, if we look at that east-west survey that I mentioned, we saw something totally different. In an area where there is no prior information, we saw a signature right at the top of that clay that, again, was unexpected. And there is no data in there. So this is what caused us to really shift our investigation to another area. And as you can see, the concentration here is less than 10 ohmmeters. It's really, really conductive. Clays can be like that, but some contaminants can also be that conductive. If we were seeing a different type of NAPL, it might be super resistive. But we'll get into that in the lessons learned. So we scanned our site, but these are really just a certain type of model. They still require another level of investigation to confirm what you're finding. I would never tell somebody to collect these surveys and then start a treatment plan. So to confirm these surveys, we planned for collecting soil and groundwater at four locations. Well, we only collected them at three. Those are indicated by the three yellow stars. Of those, we grabbed a continuous soil core. From that, we ran PID across the soil core to determine our sampling interval of each of those cores. And then if we encountered groundwater, we sampled the groundwater. We submitted all of these samples for VOC analysis because, again, we had no fuels, we had no PCBs, we had no metals, and we had no explosives. From prior investigations, they've never found any of those. So we had no reason to believe it wouldn't be that. On top of that, we have a budget we have to stay within. So in hindsight, this is one of the lessons learned. We would have done more than just sample for VOCs. The results from that, we found that upper unconsolidated layer is very sandy. It's very typical of what you would think for a classic like sedimentary alluvial setting. So you've got sands and sand silts and clays. Unconsolidated, where we found water, it flowed really well in a sand. And then again, there was no PID response in any of those locations. We collected soil cores, ran the PID, and we only had one hit, and it was less than 10 ppm. Again, remember the highest concentration in the area was over 8,000 ppm. This was less than 10. And it was only in the last 5 feet in a location that is on the distal edge of the known plume. So it's not like we were breaking ground there. It was relatively expected if you go off of the other data. So what now? Well, first thing we need to do is just wait for the VOC, for the actual analyses to come back and see if the samples we collected confirm the PID readings. Otherwise, we can hypothesize what happened. It could be metals. It could be literally anything we didn't sample for, because that's how it always works. But I think what we'll show is that it's likely a microbial source. And I'll kind of, hopefully I can convince you why. But the important thing here is that, so of all the takeaways, it's important to know that we're operating in the unknown in many of these cases, and we're trying to test theories, and electrical resistivity imaging is just one of the tools to test those theories. And the level of effort involved here is the equivalent of dozens of direct push locations. We collected 11 surveys. We ended up drilling 3 targets from 3 surveys. But we collected 11 surveys in just 3 days. We planned for a whole week, but given conditions, we were able to really get knock it out. And on top of replacing dozens of direct push locations, we also could have replaced multiple monitoring wells. But again, grain of salt, because we didn't have any VOC response. The preliminary interpretation, if we zoom in on this area, you're going to notice a couple things. One, that monitoring well maybe isn't deep enough to get a sample up gradient, but also there's a historic sewer nearby. So their preliminary interpretation for all 3 of these signatures that all look the same is likely that it's microbial in nature. It's not hard to suggest that we have a microbial community which migrated from a sewer. We know there are sewers on site. We know microbes thrive in those types of situations. So this is our initial interpretation. So some of our lessons learned, and to lead us into the remaining portion of the presentation, set your expectations, understand your goals, what each of the products are from the geophysical tools, and then have plans for what you're going to do next. We'll talk about data quality and then the potential for interference. So regarding your expectations, you need to define your goals. Are you looking for characterizing your lithology, characterizing contaminants, identifying flow paths? Well, different technology will tell you different things. This technology will tell you whether there are electrical anomalies relative to the background electrical properties. So like with lithology, if you've got bedrock, like a stark difference there, you've got an unconsolidated unit over a consolidated unit, you might see a stark difference there, sands over clays, if you've got a fracture that runs through a unit, and then flow paths. So fractures or in karst, you've got conduits, areas where there's going to be, say, more water than less water, you can use it that way. You can't necessarily use it for contaminants, for understanding concentrations. Now, the technology is useful for looking at NAPLs, DNAPLs, LNAPLs, because they're in high enough concentrations that they're either a big resistor or a big conductor. But once you get into the dissolve phase, it gets a lot more difficult to differentiate the plume, let alone get an idea of how much is there. Regarding products, so understand what the different technologies are going to give you. Again, with this one, we're looking at electrical anomalies. It's going to produce a 2D image, which can be considered a electrical cross-section of the subsurface. Together with all the other surveys and the other data, we can create a pseudo 3D model that gives you an idea spatially of where some of these signatures are that help you understand, not necessarily volume, you can use it for volume, but just give you a comparison in relation to your other data sets. And then lastly, what to do next with this data, with this information. So depending on your goals and depending on what technology you're using, here we're using resistivity, we can pick drilling targets. You can update your CSM. Much of what Ben mentioned, it helps you better plan for what to do next. It would not be smart to go from collecting this data set to prescribing a treatment plan. As hopefully I've indicated, we didn't see the area where we know we have a plume, but we did see what we're believing is a microbial community. So they're kind of flip-flop from what we would have expected going out there. So the importance of data quality. Again, so this is a separate survey that we collected there. We did not drill this survey. And part of it is because this data is relatively erroneous. The final survey shows really high resistors next to really high conductors, next to really high resistors, so on and so forth. So it looks like there's probably something else going on there, and it's not actual data. Even when we look at it in a log scale, it knocks some of that signature down, but still very, very strong signatures. So when we looked at the data misfit, you know, how well does this data compare to the model to data? We're hoping to have a bunch of green dots here because that tells us that the data that we collected is relatively close to the model to data. But we've got a bunch of red and blue dots, which are on the extremes of that data misfit. So that tells us there's a lot of noise and a lot of error in those readings. When we go to look at what electrodes were causing those, we could see that the electrodes with the most amount of noise were all pretty much next to each other. It was electrodes 53 through 64 for this survey, which includes that area. So regarding our data, we would want to remove those and reprocess it. When we do that, those signatures pretty much disappear. Even in the area where we didn't cut the data out, those signatures are greatly diminished to the point where we no longer had a drilling target. Now, we were lucky because all these data were in one section, but this doesn't always happen. If you're cutting roughly 40% of your data or so, and it's not all together, you likely have an unusable data set. And you just need to kind of keep these things in mind as you're reviewing or collecting the data. And then lastly, for the potential for interference. So again, this is a separate image, but of one of our targets, but the target isn't the important part here. What is important is that you see a couple little bullseyes of more resistive signatures, and those correlate well to where historic storm drains existed at the site. So understanding what utilities are on or at your site, or what potential for interference is there, anything that produces an EM signature or an electrical signal is going to could interfere with the overhead power lines, sewers, cables, things like that. You want to keep in mind because you may have a target that is a sewer or something that if you only had the prior information, you'd be able to avoid. In summary, you want to set your expectations. So as I mentioned, you want to make sure whatever your goals for the project are pair well with the data products from the different technology you're using. And then you want to have next steps for what you're going to do with that data, how you're going to use it to answer your questions. And then the data can either be qualitative or quantitative. We used ours in a qualitative fashion. We picked targets to drill, but we certainly could use it quantitatively. And depending on what you do with the data set, it may change your data quality objectives. And then lastly, these are geophysical tools. They're just tools. They depend on the user and the reviewer. And just because someone may be an expert in the field, it doesn't preclude them from using bad data. So garbage in, garbage out. Just be cognizant of that. So thank you. And if I have any more time, I will answer questions.
All right. Excellent. Thank you so much, John. I'll remind the audience that that Q&A button is still available at the bottom of your screen, and you can use that to privately type in your comments and questions for our presenter. I'm going to start with some that have already come in. And if the audience has no questions, you can also send that sort of message to us in the Q&A. That'll help us manage our remaining time here. One of our first questions, John, as we're waiting for some other messages as they're coming in here, is you used an acronym early in your presentation, PID. Can you define what PID is?
Yeah, so photoionization detector. It's a common tool used by industry professionals, and pretty much reacts to volatiles.
Okay. Okay. And you had mentioned interference with particular, if you're working in areas that might have things that have an EM signal, right? Can you filter out this type of interference so that the method or the tool is still usable?
I would say with this, I'm not 100% sure you can filter it out. What you can do is through the processing. So with any of this stuff, the data that you were seeing was not raw data. That was processed data. It's cleaned up. You're removing bad data, and that should be standard across the industry. So if someone is ever presenting you raw data, There's probably an issue with that. But that processing, what it'll do is takes your raw data set and a modeled data set, and it tries to compare them. And from there, you can determine how much noise is in your data set. With that, if you know that you have potential interference, while you can't necessarily take it out, it may take some of that interference out. But if, let's say, for instance, if you run it parallel to a power line, you might have an issue with your entire data set. If it's just one location where you maybe cross a couple electrodes, you might, you know, through that processing, it might pull those data values out and process it with those data points removed, and you have a perfectly fine image. It really just depends on what the interference is, where it is. At best, just try to stay away from the interference. But again, ours, we had sewers going through the site. And I wouldn't necessarily call that interference as much as I would say we knew we needed to avoid drilling through the sewer. Mm-hmm. And it helped us with our interpretation of the image. So we knew what a sewer looks like. It's relatively shallow. It's going to go in and out of an image most likely, or if it's parallel with it, mm-hmm. it may look like the same signature the entire way. Okay. But knowing what exists at the site helps us with that interpretation.
Okay. One of the participants asked if there was a way to confirm if there is a microbial community present.
Yeah, so there are companies popping up now that are sampling for microbes. I think one company, which this is not an endorsement, but it's the only one I know of at the moment, that it's called Microbial Insights. There's a lot of stuff going on with microbiologists trying to, you know, for years they've gathered DNA of different microbes. You'll see microbes being used in treatment remedies with like ISCO and ISCR, but characterizing them for these purposes to understand them is still sort of in the works. There's a whole field of study called biogeophysics, and it's trying to understand the relationship between microbial communities and geophysical. And there is some work into it, but there's not a ton yet. So there's not necessarily standard methods with correlating these signatures with that. The best thing that we can do going forward, we would have ensured that we grabbed samples from the soil and or the groundwater that would make sure that the microbes would, I guess, remain intact. I'm not 100% sure whether or not the microbial signature is active microbes or dead microbes, but more than likely we would want to appropriately sample the microbial community and send it to the appropriate lab. So that does exist. We just did not go down that avenue.
Okay. Can you explain how you determined which electrodes were sources of errors in that project?
Yeah. Let me see if I can go back. So just one example. Okay. So within the processing software, which we use, so I use Advanced Geosciences Earth Imager software to do my processing. And this is just one of the features within it, but all of your software should have some level or some ability for you to look at the amount of noise or error in your data set. That's essentially what this is. I'm able to pull up a table that tells me the amount of error or noise in that data set based on electrode. And that's based on, again, I mentioned your raw data set and like a modeled data set. That's how it's getting that reading.
All right, excellent. Can you explain what array types were used in these ERT surveys?
Yeah, so we used a combination dipole-dipole and strong gradient array. This one came directly from Advanced Geosciences. It's a survey that they, or an array that they've engineered that they give to a handful of people, but that's the array we used. It's a little bit better than the dipole-dipole. It takes the best parts of a mixed gradient dipole and or a mixed gradient array and the dipole-dipole array.
Okay. And sort of building off of that, are there any sites that would preclude the ERT method?
Oh, yeah. There are several sites. So essentially, it's going to depend on your site access. you know, if you've got people willing, if you're, you can collect this data within a building, outside of a building, over roads, over parking lots, the level of effort, you know, essentially however much you're willing to pay, they're likely to find a way to collect the data. Now there will be, again, if you have a bunch of interference, like, you know, you're collecting it adjacent to a substation, that might not be the best area to collect the data. But if you have enough money, they can typically find a way to deploy it. You wouldn't want to collect this in areas where you do expect a lot of noise. But most everything else you could be explained. You can run these in marine environments where you've got a bunch of salt water. You can run them in karst and a bunch of other settings. But again, it's going to be based off of what type of data you're wanting to collect. You can't use it to get concentrations within a plume. You can do it for trying to characterize like an apple, if that's the concentration you have, but it's, and it's useful for detecting groundwater, but it's not as stark of a difference as, say from unconsolidated to consolidated rock. There are some limitations and they've been documented in several different ways, but really you need to start with the site and the question you're trying to answer.
Okay. Would you say that this technology could be used to define a PFAS hotspot in soil?
I think that's developing. I haven't had the opportunity to do that. I know there are other researchers in ORD which have tried to do that. I'm not sure what those results are. But obviously, this is going to be the future avenue for using this technology is trying to understand it. Again, we understand that PFAS likes that air-water interface, so we mm-hmm. can use the technology to look at, you know, if we know where groundwater is, maybe we can look at the geology for the area, determine maybe is there an area where you've got higher porosity, where you might have the ability for an air-water interface? Is it in karst? Is it a cave? You know, is there a possible it's a pool of water in that cave so that the molecules might make their way to that air-water interface? That those are the sort of things you could do. You wouldn't say, are we, you know, we're looking for PFAS as much as you could look for other site characteristics that the PFAS would, you know, prefer to be. That makes sense.
Okay. How about recommendations for geophysical methods to define a confining layer in glacial till, which is roughly, you know, more than 50 feet below ground surface?
Yeah, well, so I think you can use, I mean, this technology has been used across the country in a variety of different settings. I've mostly used it in the South. There's a bunch of people, already researchers that have used it in the North and the Northwest, USGS people that have used it in the Northeast. So it's applicable in every geology. What I would say is regarding depth, these images are, let me see, they're roughly, I think, 200 meters across. And that would give us a depth of like 40 meters, or maybe it's a little more shallow. But anyways, depending on the spacing between your electrodes, that can give you more depth or less depth. If there's higher spacing between electrodes, you can get more depth, but lower resolution. If you have less spacing between electrodes, you get higher resolution, but less depth.
Okay. All right. We did have a question. Who would be typically researching the potentially interfering utilities? Is it a specialized geophysical contractor? Is it perhaps one of the primary contractors who's working on the site investigation? Who's responsible for identifying those interfering utilities?
So whoever's collecting the data, but this would be something similar to anybody in the field collecting data. They would pretty much just note, you know, if there's potential for interference, just like you would note the weather. You know, you would note if it rained the day before. If you've got saturated conditions, you're going to have better contact with the electrode and the ground between the electrode and the ground, versus if there was no rain, it's really dry. For instance, it rained at our site before we collected data. We should have had really good contact with the ground, but we had really sandy soil. So we actually did not have great contact with the ground. And that's just a typical note that I took, and it helps me explain maybe the potential for error. So anybody collecting the data should have that sort of note to help them with their interpretation, but it's not necessarily a reportable or subcontractable thing. It should just be something you can see in a field note the same way you would see it in other field notes.
Okay. And the last question that I have for you, John, have you seen many shallow refraction surveys used for site characterization?
I haven't, but I know that they're used often. That's an area that I'd like to grow in the future of my career, is using other geophysical techniques to pair them with this, because I do know that they pair well. And again, all of these are each just individual tools. So the more tools that I could add to my toolbox, I know a lot of them work. It just depends on learning how to use them properly. And same thing for anybody listening. The important part is to understand how to use them properly.
All right. Absolutely. Thank you so much, John. I know we are running right up to that scheduled end time of 2:30 p.m. Eastern. I did want to thank you so much for your time. I believe we're going to move to our closing proceedings, if that's okay with Lucy. If I can get a thumbs up, I will take over the view here.
Yep.
And I see the thumbs up. Excellent. So Lucy, I'm going to pull up a screen here. And one of the first things that I want to do is thank all of our presenters for their time and expertise, as well as the 180 of you who joined us for today's live session. As Lucy pointed out in the beginning of her session, there's a collection of websites that are available. These are publicly available resources on geophysics. We've placed those in the chat for today's session. They are also available on the seminar homepage. If you scroll through those various sections, there's a section called related links, and you'll find links to these websites along with that previously recorded webinar that Lucy highlighted in her opening section. So again, these are all currently available on that seminar homepage. And speaking of the seminar homepage, which I will pop up here in just one more moment, I do encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or cluin.org. And please be sure to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month, that highlights a free upcoming online technical training opportunities such as today's session. So as we discussed in the beginning of our session, there is a seminar homepage. That URL is shown in red on this slide. It's available from today forward. So if you happen to be watching the recorded version, you can still go to this seminar homepage and access copies of the materials, as well as the links and other resources that were discussed. On that seminar homepage, there are sections shown in gray. You may need to scroll up and down to get to the section of interest. I'll also point out there is a feedback form on that page that you can scroll down and complete. For those of you who are looking for a participation certificate based on joining us for today's session, you can obtain one by completing that feedback form. Please be sure to fill out the entire feedback form, checking the box at the bottom of the form, certifying that you are here for the entire delivery. As long as you check that box and submit your feedback, you'll then immediately have access to download or print out a certificate of participation. We'll email a copy of it to you, but sometimes those get blocked by junk or spam filters. So I encourage you to download it from the confirmation screen as soon as you submit it in. And if you happen to be one of the lucky ones joining in a group, whoever registered can share this link to the seminar homepage, and each person can actually fill out that feedback form, regardless if they registered on their own, so they can all get a participation certificate. And if you happen to be one of the lucky people replaying the recorded version, right about now above my head in the upper right corner in the archive, there'll be a button to that feedback form. You can still fill it out based off your replay, check the box certifying you watched the entire recorded session, and get a certificate for your records. So again, I'll follow up with each of you in a separate email in about 1 week as soon as this archive is available for on-demand playback. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time, and you'll join us on a future Cluin Internet seminar. With that, I'll go ahead and thank you all one last time for joining us and formally conclude today's live broadcast.